From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, Alison Brie, who was in two series at the same time. In Community, she played Annie Edison. In Mad Men, she was Trudy Campbell, Pete Campbell's wife.
We're done, Peter. This is over. I refuse to be a failure.
When Brie first got the part on Mad Men, she chose not to sign an exclusive contract, which would have limited her other options.
I loved working on Mad Men so much, but I think I felt like the character would always be someone's wife.
Brie stars in the new movie, Sleeping with Other People. Also, is being black bad for your health? Psychiatrist Damon Tweedy asked that in his new memoir, Black Man in a White Coat, A Doctor's Reflections on Race and Medicine. We'll talk about racial disparities in medicine. And David Bianculli reviews last night's premiere of The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. Before we get back to Fresh Air, here's another podcast you might enjoy, especially if you spend a lot of time connected to screens and are wondering what all that screen time is doing to you. NPR's Guy Raz and the team at the TED Radio Hour are asking that question in a special two-part episode. You can listen to Screen Time on the TED Radio Hour beginning September 11th. You'll find it at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app. Is being black bad for your health? It seemed that way when Damon Tweedy was in med school, and most of the diseases he was learning about came with the warning that they were more prevalent among black people, and that the outcome was worse for black patients than white ones. Dr. Tweedy is black and was himself diagnosed with chronic health conditions in his 20s. He's written a new memoir called Black Man in a White Coat, A Doctor's Reflections on Race and Medicine. He's a graduate of Duke Medical School and Yale Law School and is an assistant professor of psychiatry at Duke University Medical Center and a staff physician at the Durham VA Medical Center. He was raised by working-class parents. His father was raised in rural poverty, didn't finish high school, and worked for 35 years as a meat cutter in a grocery. Tweedy's mother went to segregated inner-city schools and couldn't afford college. Tweedy was given a full scholarship at Duke, and one of the issues he examines in his book is affirmative action. Dr. Damon Tweedy, welcome to Fresh Air. So when you were in medical school, and every time one of your teachers was talking about a disease and you'd be told it's more common among black people, what did you initially make of that?
There was a part of me that really wanted to find out the answer. So there was this one part that thought, well, is this just all genetic? Is this based on class? You know, is this an economic thing? You know, what is it all about? And I was just dissatisfied to almost feel as if I was not getting an answer. So that was really part of the struggle that I dealt with.
And do you feel like you have an answer now?
I think I do. I think I have a much better answer than I did then. It's almost best to think about it. There are several examples that I saw along the way that really sort of really underscore, you know, what's really going on. One time early in medical school, this is probably my third year, basically we volunteered at a rural charity clinic. It's about 90 minutes from campus. And the patients there were all African-American. They didn't have health insurance. And it was pretty clear from the beginning that you're just delivering a lower standard of care in the sense that, I mean, the doctors are doing the best they could, but the patients often couldn't afford the medications and the lab tests and all the other treatments that they needed. So that really was a real stark example of how black people in this particular case could face worse health problems in a really obvious way.
Mm-hmm. And another?
So I think there's issues at the system level. But then there's another layer when you're talking about the doctor and the patient and how they interact and so the issues around trust and communication. So those are really important and the sense that the patient has that the doctor and patient are partnering together, you know, to improve their health. So there's been a lot of things that have happened in the past that have really still impact the present. There's been a long history of African Americans being, you know, mistreated by the healthcare system. And even though it seems like a long time ago, for instance, the Tuskegee study ended in 1972. You know, that's over 40 years ago, but a lot of the people are still living from then that were around back then. And I think there's, for many people, there's a there's sort of this residual mistrust that often can manifest itself. I'll see patients now have diabetes and high blood pressure, and they're wondering, you know, are they getting the right treatment? They're feeling like maybe they're getting some kind of lower level of care, when in fact, oftentimes they're not. So that's another real important issue that's at work.
So let's get to a kind of complicated case that you had to deal with when you were a new, young medical student at Duke. You were seeing a patient who had just come in, a teenage girl who appeared to be several months pregnant and was having terrible abdominal pain, vaginal bleeding. You figured she was pregnant, but she denied being pregnant. And how did you try to find out what the problem was?
Yeah, so my first thought was that maybe there was a psychiatric illness like schizophrenia or something along those lines. I had just gotten off of a psychiatry rotation and seen people who dealt with some of those issues. Actually, what you often saw there were women who thought they were pregnant and they actually weren't. So it was sort of the opposite situation. But in talking to her, and it was pretty clear, at least from my standpoint, that it wasn't that kind of an illness she was dealing with. So then my next thought was, well, what else could sort of alter your mental state in that way? And my next thought was drug use. So I asked her about that, and she flat out denied it. And I said, well, I don't know. She said, no, where else is there to go? And my supervisor came in, and this happens in medical students all the time. So supervisor came in, asked the same line of questioning, only she was very direct and sort of like accusatory. When is the last time you smoked crack? That's the words she put in there. So I was shocked just at the way she approached the patient in that way. I'm thinking, well, why does she think that about the patient? So my first thoughts were maybe it's because the patient's poor. She's sort of kind of not that well put together, maybe because she's a young black girl. All these sorts of things were running through my mind. And then I was equally shocked when the young girl then turned around and said, yes, I smoked crack a couple of days ago. I'm like, well, why did she lie to me? I mean, what was I going to do? Why didn't she lie to me? So it was a situation that many medical students find themselves in where they kind of don't know how to ask people about these really serious and sensitive issues.
Do you think that your supervisor did the right thing in bluntly and in an accusatory way saying, when was the last time you did crack? It got a real answer, but it sounds very, like you said, very accusatory.
Yeah, I'm sure she got the right answer. Unfortunately, in this case, it didn't change the outcome. Unfortunately, in this case, the young woman, her pregnancy ended up being a stillbirth. So the fetus was about 20 weeks, and it was a stillbirth. So it didn't change the outcome. But in some cases, that could be a really important piece of information to obtain that could perhaps change things. And so, yeah, I would say that there probably could have been an easier way to have done it, maybe a less direct way. But, she was busy and this needed to be done as like a life and death kind of situation for her. So looking back, I kind of understand it. I was actually more troubled by one of the other staff members who, after the stillbirth, after it was clear that the baby wasn't going to survive, this other staff member basically was talking about sterilizing the young girl right then and there. So that was actually more troubling to me than the supervisor's approach, because it just seemed like, wow, we're just going from this to automatically sterilizing her permanently. And that just seemed a pretty harsh and drastic thing to do in that situation.
And the doctor did not think that that was an appropriate thing to do or even an appropriate conversation to have with the patient.
Right. So even though she initially came with this sort of really blunt accusatory style, she actually defended the patient against that. And she said, this is definitely not the place for this. This girl just had this traumatic experience. She has plenty of time to get her life together. Why are we we're not going to do this right now? And so I respected that. So, I think that, despite that initial sort of, I was, put off a little bit at the beginning, I think actually I was very respectful of how she handled the situation.
You had an interesting experience as a patient. When you had a sprained knee, you went to see a doctor. The doctor was white. What happened that made you feel like you weren't being treated well?
Yeah, so I had a knee that was sore. I'd been playing tennis and tweaked it in some way. And I went to an urgent care clinic after about a week or so with swelling and not going down. I tried to doctor myself like most of us doctors do. When that didn't work, went to this clinic. So the doctor walks in the room and first of all, he doesn't make eye contact. Doesn't really talk to me, just looks at my leg and has me stand up and down a couple of times. And then just says, oh, you're okay. You're fine. I knew that being a doctor, there were a lot of pieces missing. So, for instance, the doctor didn't know what kind of work I did and whether or not I needed to move around. So, and there's just a lot of gaps there. It didn't actually touch the knee or examine the knee. And so I knew that there were several things that you should probably do in this situation. And so I made the point to the doctor, well, I know something a little bit about medicine. Normally I don't do that when I'm the patient. But in this case, I felt like I had to. And the doctor was taken aback. And suddenly it was like a light went off in his head. And suddenly he looked at me. He made eye contact. He started to engage me in a conversation. Then he didn't examine my knee, touch my knee, moved it back and forth. And so, let's go get an x-ray. Let's make sure everything's okay. So it was really this that was really like I was two different people at the same time. The first person was, you know, Damien Tweedy coming off the street. And so that particular day I'd come from home and I was dressed in sweat clothes and a T-shirt. So I was very casually dressed. He may have had certain assumptions that were negative about me. But then once he learned I was a doctor, it was like I'm settling this other person and I'm worthy of a whole different level of care. So I think it really illustrates the different ways in which these things can interject in the exam room.
So you think it's very important to have more black doctors. Why do you think it's so important?
Well, first of all, if you look at what the numbers, so the general African-American population is about 13% of the country. Among doctors, it's about 4%. So it's a little higher among medical students who are training now, but overall among doctors, it's about 4%. And, you know, there's this real legacy of the healthcare system and doctors not being kind to African-Americans that still persist. Sometimes I feel like a translator in some ways. I can relate to the environment to a great extent to where they're coming from, and I'm also sort of a bridge between that and this sort of alien medical world. So I think many black doctors find themselves in that same situation. So And also, you'll find that many young black doctors are more likely to express a desire to be in a setting or a career where they're actually helping in the black community itself. So I think those are the reasons why it's really important.
When you were in medical school, you say you felt at a disadvantage academically and socially because you were from a working class background. A lot of the people at Duke were the sons and daughters of like doctors and lawyers. Your father had been a meat cutter who didn't graduate high school. Your mother couldn't afford to go to college. So going to college was a really big deal in your family. And then to make it even worse, to make it even more difficult for you, because here you are feeling like an outsider in medical school, one of your teachers, when he saw you walk into the classroom, asked if you were there to fix the lights. So that couldn't have given you a lot of confidence.
No. Yes. Yeah, so this was like about a month into that first year of medical school, and it was a break between classes, and I walked into the classroom, and this is a really bad case of mistaken identity. So the professor comes up to me somewhat angrily and says, you know, are you here to fix the lights? And, you know, why haven't you done this? I already called you about this last week. So he thought I was someone that I wasn't. So, you know, my first reaction actually was to look at myself and wonder if I had done something wrong. Like, did I not shave? Did I not dress right? What had I done wrong? And so once I realized that wasn't the case, you know, I'm looking outward and thinking, well, why does he think this about me? And so race was obviously one of the first things that did come to mind. Certainly he's probably more likely to have seen black men in that capacity at Duke. And so, I mean, but it was something that still was very, I struggled with it a lot, you know, how to deal with that, you know, hurtful thing. So the issue was then, what do I do with that? How do I deal with that situation? And so what I did is, you know, I was concerned that if I went and talked to other professors, they might not understand why I was seeing it that way. They may think that I was just trying to make a racial issue out of everything. So I was really reluctant to do that. So the way that I dealt with it was to just put everything I had into studying around the clock and showing this guy that, you know, I belong there just like anyone else.
And you did so well that he asked you later to become his assistant, and you declined.
Yeah, I mean, so the very end of the semester, I ended up getting like the second highest grade on the exam, and I went to meet with him to see if I'd, you know, gotten the honors credit, which is for like the top 5 or 10 students in the course. And yeah, it was this awkward exchange because it seemed like he recognized me from before, but he didn't want to acknowledge that. And then when he did see me, you know, when he saw the score, he sort of had this look of surprise, and it was suddenly like, you know, it was a switch. It was like the expectations are so low for a black person. If he did this well, then you really must be special. So, you know, can you work with me? And so it was like a mixed feeling. You know, there's a part of me that, you know, obviously you're happy that you've succeeded and proved yourself, but then there's sort of this like mixed legacy of the whole thing as well.
You know, we've talked a little bit about for a lot of patients who are African-American, it's important to them to see an African-American doctor, that a lot of black people are distrustful of the medical system because of just unethical experiments that had been done on black people mm-hmm. over the years, and because they sometimes feel they get substandard care, and sometimes they do. On the other hand, there are patients who don't want a black doctor, and you write about that too. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Even some black patients, like you write about a black mm-hmm. patient, you walk mm-hmm. into the room, and I'm going to quote what you write here, that the patient says, oh, they're passing you off on me, and they think I won't care because I'm supposed to be a dumb N-word. So go tell your boss, I don't want no black doctor. How did you respond to that?
Yeah, that hit me like a an uppercut, basically. So there, there's certainly a legacy. It goes back to the times of segregation, and even probably further back than that, where it's often thought that whatever was black was inferior, right? So you often would hear people say that a black doctor was inferior to, say, a Jewish doctor, or a black business person was inferior to, a white business person. So there was certainly that legacy that certainly existed because of, the history and what we had during the era of segregation. And so that was sort of a reminder that that mindset still was still out there, that I had to deal with that. So, yes, it was certainly like an uppercut. And I stumbled at first, but then I realized that this was an opportunity for me to, again, to show what my metal was made of. And that patient, I just made a commitment to really show him how much I knew and how confident I was. And, at the end of that time he was in the hospital, he actually ended up giving me a very good comment. I got to know him as a person, and we talked more. And he told me that, he really thought that I was a good doctor, and he actually said I'm the kind of doctor that he would want. So I really turned that really negative situation into a positive one. But yeah, it's still, there's this lingering sort of feeling that shows that there's still this legacy of troubling feelings about ourselves that we have to deal with.
When you were in college, the first time you dissected a rat, you fainted. Did you think that would make it impossible for you to be a medical student or a doctor?
Yeah, that was not the best first impression. So this is actually the very first day of my I was in a research lab, very, very first day. And I walk into the room, meet the guy I'm going to work with, the supervisor for the summer. And then he takes me to this room where they're where there's a lab tech, a person who's operating on these rats. And I'm talking to her, and then suddenly it's like, there's this blue spots in my vision. And then the next thing I recall is just her just saying, "Watch your head. Don't let him fall." and then there are a bunch of and then next thing I know, I'm on a stretcher, and there are a bunch of doctors talking and doctor speak and sending me to the emergency room. So that was like about the worst first impression you could ever imagine on a job. So, yeah, I think I had some doubts at that point. I think they did, too. So they brought me along a little slowly after that. I'm sure they were wary of things, but it was again one of those things where you have to can I do this or can I not? And what am I made of? And so I really just was determined that I wasn't going to let that first impression be the last thing for them. So I actually spent the whole summer there, and then came back the following year, and they gave me great recommendations for medical school. But yeah, not a good first impression.
Did it seem funny to you that here you are, like, you're 6'6", you're incredibly athletic, but you're fainting because you're dissecting a rat?
Yeah, exactly.
Right. So were you able to, like, get over that? And I'm also wondering if not feeling comfortable around, like, dissections or maybe open wounds or, blood, led to your interest in psychiatry as opposed to surgery.
When I was in medical school, I actually got over that, and I did well in my surgery rotation, and I was really all set to become a cardiologist. I was really interested in the heart. Diagnosed with high blood pressure myself. My grandmother had died from heart failure. I was really interested in the heart, and I'd done some research in that area in college and in medical school. So I thought that that's where actually I was going to head up. So I really had overcome that. And psychiatry was actually low on my list of things when I was a medical student. I actually didn't enjoy my initial rotation through the field that much. I think the switch happened during that internship year, that very first year as a young doctor. And, I found myself really gravitating towards – you'd have patients admitted to your team who had psychiatric illness, but they also had a medical problem, and that's why they had to be in the hospital. And I just found myself being really interested in their stories and learning about them and why they were doing what they did and the struggles they had. Towards the end, I got more enjoyment out of learning about people than I did, so like managing heart failure or pneumonia. And so that's really what kind of led me towards this path towards psychiatry. So it certainly was circuitous.
Were you exposed to psychiatry at all when you were growing up, or was that just kind of like outside the realm?
So you certainly would see people on television. But the interesting thing about psychiatry, and this is a whole other layer to it, but it sort of brings it back to the subject of race and medicine, is as if psychiatry is like growing up, it was like that's something for white people primarily, that black people don't go to a psychiatrist or a therapist and talk about their problems. You deal with them yourself, or you talk within family or within your church. And so I think there's certainly a whole layer that's there for that. So the idea of me being a psychiatrist was really, my mom was incredibly surprised. She's like, what are you doing? And so that is definitely not something that I grew up with at all.
Have you met patients for whom seeing a psychiatrist or admitting to having some kind of psychiatric issue is a sign of weakness, something that you're not supposed to display?
That's a huge problem. It tends to be more common in men. for sure. I mean, you know, there's the sort of the macho
man up
stance that, yeah, exactly. There's certainly that. But I think it's even, again, more common in African-American people. There's this perception that that's just not something that you do or you need to do, and that, you know, those are largely, you know, white problems. And so, you know, you can't afford to have problems like that. You have all these other real world things to deal with, right? You know, you have to deal with, you know, getting by in life and not worrying about, you know, so these other sort of things. So that's a huge issue. That's a barrier that I encounter a lot. And I try and just make it normalized. I think people have all sorts of ideas when they come to see a psychiatrist. They think that, first, they think you're going to tell them that they're crazy and that you're going to lock them up in a hospital. People are just really worried about those sorts of things. I try and just make it, you know, as normalized as possible and just say that, you know, everybody has stress. I use the word like stress because, you know, that's something people can relate to. And I try and use that as an entry to sort of get people talking about what's going on.
Damon Tweedy, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Damon Tweedy is the author of the new memoir, Black Man in a White Coat, A Doctor's Reflections on Race and Medicine. After we take a short break, we'll hear from Alison Brie, the co-star of Mad Men and Community. She stars in the new film Sleeping with Other People. And we'll find out what our TV critic, David Bianculli, thought of last night's season premiere of The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
This episode of Fresh Air and the following message come from Trunk Club, a clothing service that's changing the way men shop. With Trunk Club, you'll be connected with a dedicated personal stylist, a real person who's been trained in the complexities of fit and body type to find the best clothes to match your style, budget, and existing wardrobe. The clothes will be shipped straight to your door, and you'll have 10 days to decide which items you'd like to keep or send back. And anytime you need a new trunk, just call, text, or email your stylist at trunkclub.com/freshair.
Our guest, Alison Brie, was in two TV series at the same time, each with a devoted following. On Mad Men, she was Trudy Campbell, the wife of Pete Campbell. Pete became one of the partners at Don Draper's ad agency. On the acclaimed and frequently canceled series Community, Brie played Annie, one of the students in the community college study group. Alison Brie does voices for the Netflix series BoJack Horseman and has been in the films Get Hard, The Lego Movie, and The 5-Year Engagement. Now she's starring in the new film Sleeping with Other People, directed by Leslie Headland. Alison Brie spoke with Fresh Air producer Anne-Marie Baldonado. Let's start with a scene from Sleeping with Other People. The movie starts with Brie's character, Lainey, still in college. She has a one-night stand with Jake, played by Jason Sudeikis, and on that night, they each lose their virginity. Over a decade later, they run into each other again and find they're in a similar predicament. Both of them have become serial cheaters who can't sustain a long-term relationship. After the two of them go on a date, they decide they should keep it platonic since they're so bad at relationships.
We got to just be friends.
Yes, that is the mature, responsible thing to do for each other and ourselves. Yes, I agree. Okay, but then we got to come up with a system. If we're going to be friends, you know, and I want it to be good friends, but we got to have
fair.
A system here.
So maybe we come up with a safe word for if we're having sexual tension and then we'll stop whatever is creating.
So if you're doing something sexy or I'm doing something sexy.
We're feeling attracted.
Okay, but it's mutual, so it is mutual.
The word.
You're saying it's mutual.
Could be mutual.
That's a yes.
I may or
That's
may not need
yes.
to use the word. We'll have to see in the
okay.
future.
Okay. Well, all right. Well, let's. All right.
Say,
we'll
say
for it. Yeah, let's go.
Anything.
Come up with one.
It's,
what do you got? I'll do anything. What do you? What you pick it and yes.
It's avocado.
No, can't do that.
No.
No.
It's just immediate veto.
Mm-mm. Well, I mean, it's too sexual. It's too sexual.
Avocado is too sexual.
Oh yeah. I mean, you got to see the way I eat an avocado. You'd be like, "That's I." You know, do that to me.
Alison Brie, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
The film is about adults who have problems with love and sex and relationships. And, you know, there is adult content in this. And I read that some of the sex scenes in the script originally were more explicit than they ended up being. And mm-hmm. you said that that was something that was interesting to you just because it was different and also because it was a female director and writer. So maybe you can feel a little bit safer. Why was the edgier mm-hmm. content something that was interesting to you?
Well, the characters that I've played to this point, mostly Annie and Trudy, are a bit more conservative. Trudy, just because of her era, not just because of, I don't think Trudy would be sleeping around all the time. When I read this script, immediately I was drawn to the sexuality of this character. And knowing that Leslie had written it and was going to direct it, it felt like a safe way to explore that new ground. We had a lot of discussions about how the sex scenes would be shot before my contract was done. You know, you have to do a whole nudity rider and all that kind of stuff. So we had a lot of discussions about that stuff. And it definitely felt like a safe environment to get into that. Leslie is very, very anti-nudity in her sex scenes, which I find totally interesting.
Do you know why that is? I heard that you seemed more okay with it than she did.
I didn't want to inhibit the scenes at all. So that was more where I was coming from. I wasn't like, I'm dying to show my breasts, you know. I think it was more like, I'd rather not be nude, but I'd want the scenes to feel organic. I don't want it to seem like I'm weirdly wearing a shirt when he's totally naked or, you know, something like that. I didn't want there to be an imbalance. And she had said something to me about how she just doesn't love nudity. She finds it distracting for an audience. And I get that it sort of can take you out of it. The sex scenes in this movie are like musical numbers in a musical, I feel like, where, yes, we're singing and dancing, but only so that we can continue to move the story forward, to move the plot forward, so you can have a deeper understanding of who these people are versus, oh, Alison Brie is showing her boobs for the first time in this scene. Oh, my God, we're looking at her boobs, you know, which may happen one day. I don't know. But for now, it seemed nice to let the audience stay in the world of the characters. And also, it did seem a bit more realistic.
Now, a lot of our listeners know you from your role as Trudy Campbell from Mad Men. How did you get that role and what were you doing acting wise at the time?
I had recently graduated from college, not that recently, but recently enough that I was still living at home with my mom. And at the time, I was doing theater. I was doing Hamlet at the Rubicon Theater in Ventura County. And I auditioned for Mad Men. And the show had been picked up to series, but no episodes had aired yet at that point. So I really didn't have a point of reference except for the script. And I just, you knew it was good. The script was good. And I felt really strongly that I was going to get the part. And I went in and auditioned for just the casting directors. And I got called back to come in for Matt Weiner and the director of the episode and a few producers. And I, you know, I remember feeling great about it. Like, I know I'm going to get this. And about 2 weeks went by. I was back up in Ventura, and I was so crushed because 2 weeks is an eternity in TV. Everything gets made so fast, and it normally would mean that you definitely didn't get the part. Maybe it was just under 2 weeks, but it was a while because they actually ended up, Matt told me later that they had a whole nother casting session, and then they were down to the wire and needed to cast the part. And it was Matt who kind of went back and was like, where's that Brie girl? Find the tape for that Brie girl. And then I got the call.
In those early seasons, I always felt like Trudy was, you know, of the company wives, she was the best one. You know, she knew who to talk to at a party. She knew what she was supposed to do to help Pete sort of advance in his career. She knew she was supposed to have the bosses over for dinner. And I want to play a quick scene from season 5. Trudy really wants Don and Megan, his wife at the time, to come over for dinner at their house in the suburbs. So Don wants to cancel. He kind of wants to get out of it. So he gives Trudy a call. Don, obviously, played by John Hamm. And here you are. You're on the phone. You're feeding your daughter in the background.
Trudy, I'm glad I got a hold of you. I have some bad news.
No, you don't. We're building the whole party around you.
You see, I'm afraid we're not free.
Don, do you want to go down your list of excuses and I'll combat each one individually? Or should we just skip to the end? If you can't make it Saturday, I will reschedule. It's going to happen, and I promise you'll have a good time.
It's too bad your husband can't close a deal like this.
We both know he's doing just fine. 7:30.
That's a scene from Mad Men. Is that how you saw Trudy as this great company wife, you know, who also had ambitions herself?
It had ambitions herself, but just in that supportive way, I think, of her husband. I think all of her ambitions were funneled through Pete and, geared towards him. I mean, I love that even in that scene, she won't allow Pete to be criticized. It's like, no, no, this isn't about, you know, it's don't even say I'm better than him because we're a team and he's great and I'm also great. People have referred to Trudy as a Lady Macbeth type character, mm-hmm. and that I love. Love that analogy. And I couldn't agree more. I think it's very true that she has some of that to her where she wants to be the one steering the ship behind the scenes, but she's really the one in charge. But we also see over the seasons the power kind of shift back and forth between the two of them.
Now, I read that you had the option of to become a regular on Mad Men, meaning you would only do that show and you'd had to be ready to shoot whether they needed you or not. And you decided to turn that down. Why did you make that decision at the time?
Well, I was about to test for another show. It was prior to Community. I didn't book that show, but it was really my first time sort of doing pilot season, which as an actor, a lot of actors in LA that during pilot season go out for tons of shows and then they test at the network level and they test at the studio level. And it's this huge thing that happens every year. I had never really experienced it. Mad Men was one of my first jobs ever. It was my second job ever on television. And I loved working on Mad Men so much, but I think I felt like the character would always be someone's wife. It's such a large ensemble on that show that I think I sort of felt like, I don't know how much more they would even be able to do with me. Like, so it seemed like a silly decision to give them full control of my schedule for about the same amount of money when I could do that at the same time and have some freedom to do other things. Of course, I didn't book the show that I tested for, and I immediately regretted the decision and I spent the rest of pilot season like, oh, God, I hope something else comes up because did I just close this massive door and what's going to happen? And then Community came up so quickly that I think we didn't even have time to kind of run it by the folks over at Mad Men. I don't think that went over too well, but luckily all of the producers on Community were big Mad Men fans, so they were pretty open about letting me continue to recur over there, which is, it's not unprecedented, but normally with the contracts that you sign as a regular on a network show like NBC or CBS or ABC, they limit the amount of guest star appearances you can do to 2 or 3 or 1. Mm-hmm. So every year we did have to ask permission from NBC, and sometimes it was more difficult and sometimes it was a little easier. But every year that I was working on Community, we did have to kind of get their approval for me to keep going back over to Mad Men.
Well, at the end of the show's run, Matt Weiner, the creator of Mad Men, he didn't do that many interviews, but he did talk a little bit to the press. And someone asked him who he would want to check in with decades later, like who he would want to have coffee with. And he said Trudy Campbell. Did that surprise you, or did you know that?
I did not.
Yeah, he said, quote, or at least I think, quote, I just think she'd be a dynamite old lady. Does that surprise you?
I couldn't agree more.
How does that make you feel?
It doesn't surprise me at all. It makes me feel great. It does not surprise me at all. Trudy is a great character. And I think all along when we were shooting the series that Matt was always pulling from people he knew, qualities from his parents, his friends' parents, and other people growing up. It's wonderful to hear that she had a special place in his heart. She is a dynamite character.
We're listening to the interview that Fresh Air producer Anne-Marie Baldonado recorded with Alison Brie. Brie stars in the new movie Sleeping with Other People. They'll talk about her role on the series Community after a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air comes from Cleveland Clinic, where concerns about prostate cancer are met with hope and innovative treatments. Cleveland Clinic offers a top-ranked urology program in the nation, according to U.S. News and World Report. For the latest information on prostate cancer, or to get a second opinion, visit clevelandclinic.org/urology. Same-day appointments are available. Cleveland Clinic. Every life deserves world-class care.
Let's get back to the interview Fresh Air producer Anne-Marie Baldonado recorded with Alison Brie, who stars in the new movie Sleeping with Other People. Brie played Trudy Campbell in Mad Men. On the comedy series Community, she played Annie, a student in a community college study group. Here she is in the first season talking to a professor played by John Oliver.
Professor Duncan! Professor Duncan! Annie Edison, I'm in your 101 lecture.
Hello.
I've heard about your special psych lab.
Ah, the Duncan principle.
Yes, and I know it's limited to second year students, but I had a 4.0 at Riverside High, and I'm not looking down on the school at all, but I'm only here because of a brief addiction to pills that I was told would help me focus, but they actually made me lose my scholarship and virginity.
Right.
If you would let me take your lab early, it would be a real feather in my transcript.
Now, while you were doing Mad Men, you're obviously also on this other huge, you know, a show where the fans are totally rabid of Community. And there were times where you're shooting both shows at the same time. Was it weird going back and forth on these two shows? Did you ever have to shoot on the same day? Or is that something that all actors do, sort of go from one job to another?
There were only probably a couple days that I shot on the same day because that's crazy. I don't think a lot of people do it. There are other actors who work on two shows, so I can't really speak to what their schedules are like. But it definitely felt kind of crazy in the moment, especially because over at Community, our hours were very long and the characters were usually all together. It was very seldom that storylines were broken up and having characters just in twos and threes. It was like the whole study group together all the time. So it was hard to find time to get away at all, which is why sometimes it had to be on the same day where they'd be like, okay, we can give you the morning, but you have to be here by 3. To me, those days were just very exciting. It was really exciting. These were my first two big jobs. They're still my two biggest jobs. And it felt like how I had always imagined in my romanticized version of being a working actress, what it would feel like, you know? Got to dash off to my other job, get back into hair and makeup. Now I'm a totally different character. It was exciting.
Now, Community, at least on paper, sort of started out as kind of a take on workplace comedy, you know, like a group of diverse people together at a community college. And then it sort of became this like odd, magical show that was super meta. When you first saw the script or when you guys first started making the show, did it feel that odd? You know what I mean? Like, did the meta stuff sort of come as you guys started making more episodes?
Yes, definitely. The pilot episode was pretty straightforward, and I was drawn to it. Joel was attached. Chevy Chase was involved. It was incredibly well written, but it wasn't until maybe about the 6th episode of the show that things started to really gel with the cast and with the writers, and then they started to get real weird. I'd say the 6th episode, I'm pretty sure that's what it was, our Halloween episode, which I think a lot of us would pinpoint as the episode where things really started to come together. I think there was a little bit of time at the beginning where the writers were learning what our strengths were as actors and sort of how to write to that, and all of us sort of gelling together as a cast. And also, I think there's like a trial period. It's a new show. I'm sure Dan was very aware of writing a show.
Dan Harmon, the creator.
Yes, to appease a network, a show that a network is going to like and want to keep on the air that feels accessible. And the show was sort of initially accepted by NBC, though never adored. Then I think just more and more of Dan started to seep into the show.
So you grew up in South Pasadena.
Yes.
What was it like growing up there? Because, you know, it's Southern California, so you're sort of closer to the TV and film industry. Does living, you know, in close proximity make acting seem like a more attainable career?
I think so, yes. Well, one, my father worked as an entertainment journalist, and also he's a musician, and he's a singer-songwriter and was always writing music and performing. So there was that sort of artistic thing happening in our family all the time, and me sort of being like, oh, you know, my father dropped out of law school to be a musician. So that's an acceptable thing to do, just already as an example in my own family. But also in South Pasadena, because it looks like it could be anywhere in the U.S., it looks like a very quaint small town. A lot of movies are shot there. So while Hollywood wasn't on my radar as a kid, like, I definitely didn't want to act until I was an adult. I wanted to go to high school and go to college and then start working. But it was, you know, I do remember when I was in middle school walking home and they were shooting this movie called Bye Bye Love that stars Matthew Modine and Paul Reiser.
Oh.
And some AD, you know, some assistant stopped me and asked if they could, like, paid me $10 to use my binder in the movie. He, like, bought my folder from me. And it was exciting. I remember feeling excited. Wow, they're shooting that movie down the street at next to Sarah's house. And, you know, my binder is going to be in that movie. It just sort of was a cool thing. At my high school, they had shot the original Halloween there, and you could see my locker. At the time, you could. They've since demolished and rebuilt the whole school, so it doesn't really look like it looked when I went to school there. But there were cool things like that. They shot Old School right down the street from my high school, so we would occasionally, like, drive past the Old School house. And, you know, the actor that played Steve Urkel went to my high school before I went there. And so did, you know, they shot the Beethoven movies, you know, the ones about the dog.
Mm-hmm.
That mythology was all there. You'd hear these stories about people acting and doing that kind of stuff. So it seemed like it was within reach.
Allison Brie, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Allison Brie spoke with Fresh Air producer Anne-Marie Baldonado. Brie stars in the new movie Sleeping with Other People. Last night was the first edition of The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. Our TV critic, David Bianculli, will review the premiere after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Before we get back to Fresh Air, here's another podcast you might enjoy, especially if you spend a lot of time connected to screens and are wondering what all that screen time is doing to you. NPR's Guy Raz and the team at the TED Radio Hour are asking that question in a special two-part episode. You can listen to Screen Time on the TED Radio Hour beginning September 11th. You'll find it at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app. Last night, Stephen Colbert inherited David Letterman's program, Time Slot, and Ed Sullivan Theater as the new Late Show host on CBS. The big question asked in advance was whether Colbert would be as funny and entertaining after shedding the fake conservative pundit he played for years on The Colbert Report. And according to our TV critic, David Bianculli, the big answer is yes.
Tonight, Stephen welcomes George Clooney, Governor Jeb Bush, musical guest Mavis Staples and friends, featuring John Batiste and Stay Human, come on. And now it's time for The Late Show with Stephen Colbert.
First nights on TV talk shows provide quick and sometimes misleading first impressions. As Stephen Colbert joked in his opening monologue, he had 9 months to plan his first show. But these first impressions do count for a lot, especially about the structure and atmosphere a new host brings to the job. Colbert didn't mess with the existing structure of The Late Show itself. Opening monologue, sit behind a desk, interview a few guests, showcase some music at the end. But the interior structure of the Ed Sullivan Theater was significantly different. So much so that one of the opening night guests, Republican presidential candidate Jeb Bush, took note.
The White House is not nicer than this. I want you to know that. You got more pictures of yourself than I thought you would have had.
There are a lot of pictures of me in here. I used to play a narcissistic conservative pundit. Now I'm just a narcissist. No.
No, Stephen Colbert is a lot more than that. He opened the show with a film montage showing him singing harmony on the Star-Spangled Banner with various people across the country, and closed it by joining new Late Show band leader John Batiste and his band Stay Human and special guests on a high-energy performance of Sly and the Family Stone's Everyday People. So, as Colbert has proven by performing in a concert version of Stephen Sondheim's Company, he really can sing. He acted as his own announcer, introducing the evening's talent, including himself. He did a solo comedy bit, gorging on Oreos in response to Donald Trump's recent rejection of them. He delivered a short but solid monologue, and, interviewing his guests as himself rather than the character he played on Comedy Central, acted as straight man to George Clooney and genial inquisitor to Jeb Bush, whose stated desire to bring people together brought this response from the host.
Do you think that you could bring people together? Because everybody says they want to bring people together. But when you get down to the campaigning or get down to what passes for governing now, it often ends up being just a game of blood sport.
You know,
you attack the other person and the other side can't possibly do, say, or have planned for anything good.
So I'm going to say something that's heretic, I guess. Mm-hmm. I don't think Barack Obama has bad motives. I just think he's wrong on a lot of issues. Mm-hmm. I don't ascribe...
Oh, you were so close to getting them to clap. You were this close.
No, but look.
You got to pause. You got to pause till they clap and then hit them what they don't want to hear.
Showmanship is something Stephen Colbert knows very, very well. That's why the choice of John Batiste as bandleader is such a good move. As good as Jimmy Fallon's move to appoint the Roots as the house band for NBC's Tonight Show. Fallon, too, showed up in a friendly filmed cameo. So Colbert was acknowledging the present leader of late-night TV. But Colbert, whose sentimental but heartfelt salute to Jon Stewart was a highlight of Stewart's final Daily Show, also found time on his first Late Show to salute his predecessor properly and graciously.
And I just want to say that it is possible to lose sight of how much Dave changed comedy. The comedy landscape is so thickly planted with the forest of Dave's ideas that we sometimes need to remind ourselves just how tall he stands. So just for the record, I'm not replacing David Letterman. His creative legacy is a high pencil mark on a doorframe that we all have to measure ourselves against.
On Colbert's opening Late Show, he made it a welcome sandbox for Republicans as well as Democrats. An instant and important distinction from the Colbert Report. Jeb Bush, George Clooney, John Batiste, even Colbert, everyone seemed to enjoy himself. And that's an emotion that translates very well through the TV set. The inaugural Late Show with Stephen Colbert was so packed with comedy bits, special guests, and music, it went several minutes overtime. But it didn't feel long. It felt good.
David Bianculli is founder and editor of the website TV Worth Watching and teaches television and film history at Rowan University in New Jersey. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, what does it really mean to conduct mass deportations? Donald Trump's immigration plan calls for the deportation of Mexicans who are in the U.S. illegally. The U.S. did deport an estimated 1 million Mexicans and Mexican Americans in the 1930s during the Depression. We'll talk about this little-known chapter of American history with Francisco Baldarrama, the author of Decade of Betrayal, Mexican Repatriation in the 1930s. I hope you'll join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. I'm Terry Gross.